This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. Listen to any blues song, and it's easy to infer that blues musicians know a thing or two about hardship. They sing about adultery, alcoholism, poverty, love, and loss. The music, concise, but poignant. All too often, blues artists' talents go underappreciated. They play when they can, wherever they can. Making a living as a blues musician is difficult. Many can't afford food, health care, shelter, or transportation. And that's where the Music Maker Relief Foundation comes in. The group records older, low-income musicians, sets up concerts, and makes sure that blues musicians have basic life needs. We're talking about meals, medical care, and a roof over their head. Tim Duffy started the Music Maker Relief Foundation. He is its president. He joins us today. Tim, thanks for being here.
All right, really appreciate being here.
And we welcome your calls this hour at 1-877-962-9862. Tim, do you remember the first time you heard the blues?
Yes, I was brought up with Lead Belly Records and Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee when I was like 4 or 5 years old. I just remember Sonny Terry playing the Fox Chase. I just loved it.
Did you learn to play that?
No, I never learned to play. I got to meet Sonny and go to his house, but that's just, you know, ever since that time, I just loved those old records. But I was living in Connecticut, so it was just records. It wasn't life for me. It was not till I moved, till some of the southern musicians I met, like Sonny and Brownie and Son Thomas came to my hometown, that I got to meet them. And when I got old enough to travel and leave home, I came to North Carolina.
So you've been playing this music, been around this music for three decades or more.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. What got you interested in preserving the music and helping the blues artists?
I've been running around with a camera and a tape recorder since I was 16, traveling and meeting elderly musicians that made 78s in the 30s. And when I graduated from folklore at UNC Chapel Hill, I was studying with a guy named Guitar Slim Stevens. And he turned me on to a guy named Guitar Gabriel. And this fella and him and Slim introduced me to this whole host of musicians, dozens of musicians that weren't in the books, that hadn't been recorded, and a whole world here in North Carolina of just great artists that no one heard about. And I was in, you know, just loved it. But, you know, when you saw the decisions they had to make between buying food or buying some prescription medicine or going to the gig and the lights were turned off and they were too worried about getting the lights turned on because, yep, here's Etta. So I just love the music and people like Etta Baker, you know, was the one woman I was a kid at that she had a record out, Hills of the Caldwell County. I heard that. I wanted to meet that woman and learn how to play one dime blues.
Well, let's talk about Etta Baker. She was born in Caldwell County, picked up the guitar when she was a child. I'm told she plays in a distinctive traditional Piedmont finger picking style. She's just released a new CD on the Music Maker label with Taj Mahal. She's almost 92, still playing guitar, and joins us by phone from her home near Morganton. Miss Etta?
Uh-huh.
How are you today?
Oh, I'm much better. I have really been sick, but the good Lord is bringing me back.
Well, I understand you worked in a textile mill most of your life, raised nine...
Well, I worked there 25 years.
Raised nine children.
And retired in 73.
Okay, you raised nine children, didn't you?
Raised nine children, two sets of twins.
Two sets of twins. How did you find time to play music?
Well, I made myself. I just loved it, so I had to find a little place for that, too.
And where and when would you play?
Oh, I've been Blue Hill, Maine. Seattle, Washington, Columbus, Ohio.
You've been around.
Been around in Texas, Florida.
Who are some of the famous musicians other than you? Of course, you are famous within your own right, but who are some of the other famous musicians you've played with?
Well, I would say Chet Atkins was one of my top favorites, and B.B. King, Ray Charles.
And you still play today?
That's right.
Okay, you play with Taj Mahal on your newest
album.
That's
right.
How was that?
Oh, that was great.
So we've got modern technology here with a cell phone. It's it's interesting to watch a musician jump like that to turn down some sound. We talk about Taj Mahal playing on that album. You said it was great. One of the songs from another album you made for Music Maker was called Going Down the Road Feeling Bad. You
right.
like that song. Can you remember where you learned to play that?
Well, that was my dad's song. That's one of the first tunes I learned, sitting up in the middle of the bed, strumming on my little guitar. That's one of my first pieces from my dad that I learned.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of that. It's called Going Down the Road Feeling Bad.
That's right.
You know, you talked about playing with Chet Atkins. I remember interviewing him a couple of years before he died.
Uh-huh.
And part of the success he told me about was that he liked to play things softly so you could hear everything that was being played.
That's right.
What I'm hearing from you sounds a whole lot like that.
Uh-huh.
Tell me how you got involved with the Music Maker Relief Foundation.
Well, Tim Duffy came by. And he was talking, and he said he would make CDs and cassettes for me. And I played a few tunes, and, oh, that's been several years ago. But how come my music to spread? Well, I give a lot of this to Tim Duffy.
Tim, when you hear Miss Etta talk about the work and your vision, it has to be rewarding.
Ed is she's been a great inspiration for musicians for over 50 years, so it's a great honor to hear that.
Miss Etta, if a younger person came to you today and said they wanted to learn the guitar, they wanted to follow in your footsteps, what would you tell them is the first step for them to take?
Well, I would tell them that I would go over the tune. When I started making music, there wasn't no written no sheet music. And so I dream a lot of my chords. And any young person comes by and want to learn, I do my chords real, real slow, and it's not very long till they play in the same tune.
Do you play the guitar every day?
Just about every day, but I've been real sick for a little while, but I'm recovering now and playing again.
Well, we are glad you are feeling better. And
well, thank you, dear.
And wish you a very Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you, thank you.
Miss Etta Baker has played guitar for nearly 8 decades and is a recipient of the Music Maker Relief Foundation. She joined us from her home near Morganton. Tim, how many other Miss Ettas are there out there?
Miss Ettas, none.
How many others are there who need the assistance?
Oh,
of what your
we have about 100 artists that we work with, and it's sad every day and every week I hear of more artists that need assistance. So there's thousands of artists out there that need this kind of help.
How do you find them, or do they find you?
Well, in the early days, I did a lot of original field work, traveling around small towns throughout the South looking for these people that have held on to the older styles of music. And now, as word of mouth has grown, a lot of people find me. I just found a man named Adolphus Bell, a one-man band artist from Birmingham that I've been looking for 10 years. I just met him, and we've been doing shows together. It's a lot of fun. So I hear things. I hear talk. I stay close to musicians, and musicians tell other musicians. And, you know, what we're really trying to find is the original true pioneers and forgotten heroes of the roots of American music, either be it Appalachian old-time mountain music or blues music or jazz, you know, the people that have made a huge contribution. But people like Etta, even if their records before haven't sold a lot, look how many people they've influenced in their neighborhoods that have gone on to change the course of American music. So we like to just help these people, give them a push and amplify them and let people know about, you know, the our greatest cultural resource.
Before we take a break, tell me how Piedmont blues, Delta blues, Chicago blues, how do they differ?
Well, the blues came from Africa, and it came throughout all the different parts of the regions. There's and everywhere has a different style and a different taste. And the Piedmont has a more of a ragtime sound. The Mississippi blues has a harsher sound. When it went to Chicago, it got amplified. People like Lightnin' Hopkins out in Texas and Blind Leverett Jefferson were great poets. So everything's a little different, and it's all wonderful.
This is The State of Things. We're talking today about the Music Maker Foundation with Tim Duffy, the founder and president of the organization. Band Together is a series of concerts to benefit the Music Maker Relief Foundation. The next event will be January 20th at the BTI Fletcher Opera Theater in Raleigh. For more information about the concert and the Music Maker Foundation, go to our website, the SOT page at WUNC.org. Just ahead, we'll hear some live blues here in the studio. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. A lifetime as a musician does not necessarily lead to wealth and fame. Many blues musicians require some assistance, and that's where the Music Maker Foundation comes in. Tim Duffy founded the Music Maker, and he's with us in the studio. We were just talking about Miss Etta Baker.
Uh-huh.
And how she influenced some major names in the music
yep.
back during the 60s
yep.
and really never had any compensation.
No compensation. She had a record out in 1956, and we just influenced people like Bob Dylan. Taj Mahal cites her as her sole, you know, influence. Of
getting Tell me about the lick that Bob Dylan used.
Oh, so Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. You know, there's Paul Clayton is a very famous folk singer, recorded that record, and he was good friends with Bob Dylan, and he brought him down there for his 21st birthday. And you can hear it on that first record, that gentle Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. It's like it's pretty much the chords of One Dime Blues that Etta put out. Was a very famous lick. All the folkies were playing at that time.
Do you play that lick? And Miss Etta
yeah.
basically developed that.
Yeah, well, she's the one that all those people in the early 60s were listening. Those folk singers in New York and the Greenwich Village were listening to this record because Paul Clayton was a very famous man.
John D. Holman is a blues artist from Orange County. He's received a National Endowment for the Arts National Heritage Fellowship and a North Carolina Folk Heritage Award. He joins us here in the studio. John D., good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
He brought his guitar as well. We're going to hear a little of that in a moment. Tell me where you grew up and how you learned to play.
Well, when I was born in Hillsboro. Stayed there until I was 5 or 6 years old, and I moved north of Hillsboro with my father. So we bought about 100 acres of farmland. So that little place right in there they call Timberlake.
And there were some musicians in your family, right?
Yeah, I had an uncle. He could play one. And I had a second cousin. He could play. But they didn't take up too much time with me in playing because they figured I was too young to learn. So I had to get it the hard way.
Does that mean you taught yourself?
Well, I really did teach myself. My uncle, he showed me the tune. And I tried to get him to show me to play. So he just said, well, the first thing, I have to learn to tune it. So I had to walk about 4 miles to get him to tune it. He said, when I tune it for you, you go back and get out of tune. So what you going to do then, walk back? I was thinking it was going to stay in tune. He said, it won't stay in tune.
So I think if you had to walk 4 miles, it'd be out of tune by the time you got back home.
That's correct. The air knocking out of tune, but I didn't know it then, but I found out since then.
When did you start playing publicly?
Well, when I started playing publicly, it was 1976 at Eno Farm there in Durham.
Where all have you played?
Just by name, it's hard for me to name it all.
Might be easier to name where you haven't played, I guess.
Well, I've been to Africa, stayed out for 6 weeks. I've been to Amsterdam, Turkey, Seattle, Boston, Massachusetts, Canada, Winnipeg, just all around. I can't even name them all, but I've been quite a few places.
You brought your guitar, and it's a beautiful steel guitar, I was told earlier.
That's correct.
It's shiny. Tell us about the song you're going to play.
Well, the first song I'm going to play is one by, when I heard it over there, record label of Brown McGee's Sonny Terry. The thing entitled, I Got a Key to the Highway.
Key to the Highway. Let's hear a little of this.
I've got the key to the highway. Bill down there now, better go. I'm gonna leave here running because walking this mode's too slow. When the moon throws the mountain, I will be on my way. I'm gonna roam this highway on till the break of day. Give me one more kiss, mama, just before I go. I'm gonna leave here walking cause moves too slow. So long, darling. So long, darling. I must say goodbye. I'm gonna roam this old highway until the day I die. I got the key to the highway. Be down and I'm better go. I'm gonna leave here walking cause my name moves too slow. Keys to the Highway.
Keys to the Highway. That's John D. Holman, accompanied by Tim Duffy, founder of the Music Maker Relief Foundation. It's an honor to sit here and listen to you perform. Did you write that song?
No, I got that from Sonny Terry and Brown McGee when I was a boy, and I kept that in my mind until I started playing the guitar. That was the most big, I believe, 7-8 record I used to listen to when I was a boy, and so I just kept all that in mind until I learned to play the guitar. You know.
When did you first meet Tim?
It was back in the 70s, 80s. Yeah, in the 80s.
And how did you end up working together with the Music Maker Relief Foundation?
Well, after I started, I liked it okay. I just got, you know, places every once in a while for somebody hear about me, and they would ask me direct that I want to do a show for them, so that's where I was going. So after I started with him, I just wanted to keep up with the Music Maker.
Do you remember the first time you were taken into a studio and had the opportunity to record?
Not right offhand, I don't, but...
It had to be quite an experience, though, to have taught yourself how to play. You grew up in a family of people playing, had to walk 4 miles to get your guitar tuned, and then there's great legitimacy. I mean, all of a sudden, someone wants to record your music.
That's correct. So back in the 80s, I was in out from Washington, a place called Silver Spring, Maryland.
Joe Wilson, right?
For Joe Wilson.
Yeah.
So I recorded, my first recorder was there.
What's your favorite type of blues, John D?
Oh, I pretty well much hang on after Lightning Hawkins and... Brown McGee, B.B. King, Muddy Water, that type of music. I like that type of music.
And a lot of major rock and roll people influenced by the blues.
All of them.
The Stones talk about it from their inception. The Beatles talked about it from their inception. The list just goes on and on and on of people who have made millions of dollars in the music industry that were influenced by this type of music.
That's correct.
Tim, let's talk about some of the more of the work that the Music Maker Relief Foundation is doing and why it exists and why it is needed. they're musicians in this area.
Yep, lots of them.
That you're working with.
Sure. I wish I could work with them all. We have different programs. We have the Life Sustenance Program. Is just, you know, an artist can't think about playing music if they're just, you know, they're going to be put out on the street, or they can't afford heating oil, or too hot in the summertime, need air conditioning, or have a glaucoma medicine, and, you know, they're living off $300 a month and need $200 a month for medicine. So we try to take care of that need first. And then we have artist development. Is that where we invite artists to come to our studio for a time to be creative, or we go out there and we help make records and make a CD and make a package and help them with their development so they can have something that we can present to festivals and talent buyers so they can get out. Or if they can't travel, they have something to sell in their community to make extra money. And that goes to our cultural access program, as things, making things like this happen, go to radio shows, go to, like, we're going to Coup d'Etat, we're going to France and Belgium next month, or we're taking a whole, you know, about 15 artists down to Australia and over Easter. So, you know, get the word out about the blues through publications and stuff like that.
This type of music, blues, has an intense loyalty. I mean, people who love the music love it.
Yeah.
But it appears it's been a fairly narrow audience for a while. Do you sense it's expanding?
I think the blues will never die. It's something that's always been popular, and, you know, since it came off the ships from Africa and at first, in its mysterious beginnings, people loved it, and people all the way up to now love it. You know, so when I was a little kid, my dad was buying the records. I'm still buying the records now.
Would you consider songs that have been sung in fields,
uh-huh,
for the Menhaden fishermen who used to mm-hmm sing, to have a rhythm so they could pull those hues? That's part of blues, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all the blues. You can take, you know, anything. Blues is a feeling. It's how, you know, people express themselves, and, you know, maybe a woman quit somebody and they're singing a song about it, or maybe they're feeling good because she came home, or, you know, there's as many uplifts and downfalls, and just it's how it makes you feel. John Dee's a better one. You have him. You should ask him that. You know, he's the one to explain what the blues are better than me. I'm just a
John Dee, give me
observer.
Give me your definition of the blues.
I think the foundation of the blues are good man feeling bad.
Good man feeling bad, like B.B. King. Did he get that from you, or did you get that from him?
I really just picked it up myself, you know, just a good man feeling bad, because if you feel, you're going to feel bad if you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You will not feel good from it, and so
what was it you told me earlier? I made a note of this. You said, my problem is I got too many problems. Or I got too many problems, that's my problem. That sounds like the title of a new song.
That's true.
I understand you're going to play another song for us, Chapel Hill Boogie.
Okay, I'll do that. Okay, that's one I put together in 80. I named it Chapel Hill Boogie. It's a little place called Tin Top out here, real rough, back in the 1960s. I didn't go there about a couple of times. That was two times too many. They were throwing bottles, rocks, knives flying.
And you wrote this. And you wrote this song about it.
Yes, I did.
All right, John Dee Holman and Tim Duffy.
All night long, I was standing on a corner with a glass in my hand. Little chick come by, say, "Ooh, that's my man." Do the boogie, do the chapel hill boogie, do the chapel hill boogie, where the boogie all night long. Boogie what? To fuss and fight, do the boogie, do the chapel hill boogie, do the chapel hill boogie, by the boogie all night long. And the other little kids, they was all standing around. They all done a boogie till the sun went down. Do the boogie, do the boogie.
John D. Holman, Tim Duffy, Chapel Hill Boogie. Now, the whole time you were singing that, you had this great smile on your face.
Thank you.
So it's blues that can make you really feel good.
Well, that's true. Thinking about all the dillment I have seed and all, it makes me laugh now.
All the devilment you have seen over the years. Well, but there's also something about a very sad song. A sad blues song that has this way of making us feel good even in the midst of the pain.
What is true?
I mean, that's true. Any of those songs like that come to mind, Tim? I mean, they're, you know, Elton John wrote about it in that song called Sad Songs. You know, they make you feel so good.
Man, there's so many good ones. Well, Eddie Baker's One Dime Blues is like that for me. John D. Holman sings so many great ones. Things I Used to Do, I Won't Do Them No More. I love when I hear him sing that one.
Did you write that one?
I think that's by Muddy Water.
Things I Used to Do,
mm-hmm.
I Don't Do No
I
More. Is that
it? I can't do it no more.
So it's not always by choice you don't do them. It's the fact that you just cannot do them. Tim, you talked about going to Australia.
Yeah.
You talked about going to Belgium,
yeah.
Did you say? How many musicians will be involved in these trips?
Oh, you know, from 2 to 7, we have a great event with Derek Trux coming up with the band together, and we're going to have John D. Holman there and Cool John Ferguson and Cootie Stark from Greenville, South Carolina will come up. My problem is when I have shows, I always overbook them. I want to bring Micah Vine Hayes and Whistling Britches and
Everyone have a nickname?
Well, Whistling Britches, I found out he signed a book that we wrote the other day. He signed it Whisper Pants, so now we call him.
Well, and you're Tim Duffy. Do they have a nickname for you?
I had probably behind my back they had to after. I don't know if they have one or not.
Well, in this concert
Old Tim,
that's coming,
that's what Cootie calls me.
This concert coming to Raleigh,
yep.
At the Fletcher Opera,
yep.
Hall.
Yep.
That's a great hall to play,
oh,
and
it's
with
great.
Wonderful acoustics.
Yeah, it's great. A great group band together out of Raleigh's put that together, a guy named Neil Davis.
And the type of music we're going to hear, more of the same of what we're hearing.
Well,
today.
It's, you know, we have a wide range. In Cool John is almost a futuristic, you know, been acclaimed with one of the world's stellar electric guitar players. And John D. Traditional and Cootie, even deeper traditional.
Our deep thanks to blues musicians Miss Etta Baker, John D. Holman. Also thanks to Tim Duffy, the founder and president of the Music Maker Relief Foundation. One of the ways Music Maker raises funds is through releasing music collections. This is Cool John Ferguson's version of Jingle Bells, which is off the Cool Yule CD from Music Maker. This is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. Corey Harris is a real student of the blues. You may have seen him as the narrator and guide for Feel Like Going Home, the documentary Martin Scorsese directed for his PBS series The Blues. For Harris, the blues is a living music. He loves to find connections between old and new, near and far. In Scorsese's film and on his own recordings, Harris has explored the musical connections between the Mississippi Delta and the West African country of Mali. Harris explores other musical connections on his CD, Down Home Sophisticate, which got 4 stars from Rolling Stone. This is how Corey Harris describes his music in his own words.
There is music that's really good, but also very studied and very, like, didactic. I don't want that in my music. Down Home Sophisticate. I call my music diaspora rock. You know, it embraces a lot of different things, but it presents a united style. When I think about the blues and hip-hop, well, one is the father and one's the son. Couldn't have hip-hop without blues, because blues is really the fundamental expression that we as black people have brought to the world.
I've gotta see Black Angel.
It's pretty much the chronicle of what we've been through, from leaving the continent of Africa to slavery and then on through Jim Crow and all those other things.
Well, Grandpa told Junior what? About them slavery, huh? About them slavery, slavery. After all these years, son, still got them slavery away. Still got them slavery away.
I'd been listening to Malian music for quite a while, but it wasn't until my third visit to Mali that I really began to play some of the music. And that was due to my meeting with and learning from Ali Farka Touré. Call that, but that's a rhythm I heard a lot in Mali. Whereas with the blues, it'd be like. I would say that a lot of the rhythm in Mali, to me, to my ears, sounds a lot more cyclical and circular. The goal is not to sound like someone else, but to discover new aspects of your own musical self. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Corey Harris, slide guitarist, singer, and student of the blues. We heard from him as part of Musicians in Their Own Words, produced by David Shulman and supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Winter weather varies greatly in North Carolina. It's not uncommon for us to have snow, crippling ice storms, or mild 60-degree days. So what's in store for us this season? Could we wake up to snow, even a few flurries, on December 25th? Greg Fischel is chief meteorologist at WRAL-TV, joins us now by phone to talk about winter weather. Greg, good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, how far in advance are you able to forecast?
It depends on how much detail you require. When we talk about these seasonal forecasts, like for the winter or for a hurricane season, you can talk about very general trends, like, for instance, this winter, the odds favor that we're going to have below normal temperatures and at or above normal precipitation. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be any dry stretches or any mild stretches. It just means that when you add everything up at the end of the winter, that's the way it's likely to be. If you want details day to day, it's my own personal feeling that we're pushing it even going 5 days, that if I had my druthers, I'd probably do a three-day forecast on TV and then talk about trends after that.
Yeah, looking at the overall picture, can you tell when you look at what we're expecting with colder temperatures and possibly more precipitation, if it has the makings for a potential nasty winter with ice storms and such?
It's really hard to, I think, more than 4 or 5 days in advance to get a good handle on that, because one thing I like to point out to people is that we could have a whole bunch of sunny, cold days and several 35-degree rainstorms, and we would end up with a colder-than-normal winter and a wetter-than-normal winter, but there wouldn't be any snow. So there's a whole, it's almost like there's a destination and there's a whole bunch of different pathways you can use to get there.
Yeah, what do you think of what we've had so far? I mean, obviously we're just into the third day officially of winter, but
right.
As far as the cold weather is concerned, we've had bitter cold, it's been temperate, it may shock us at times, but isn't this fairly typical?
It is. We're at a latitude where, you know, we've got cold air to the north and warm air to the south, and as soon as the wind changes direction, the changes can be dramatic, and we saw that this week. On Monday, we just had a high of 28, which is about as cold an air mass as you're ever going to see in this part of the country, very, very few any colder. And then one day later, we're 28 degrees warmer at 56. So as the old saying goes, variety is the spice of life down here.
Well, speaking of down here, you've been down here, what, 23, 24 years now?
Yeah, 23 and a half, but who's counting?
Yeah. Any basic trends that you have seen in North Carolina weather since you moved here?
Well, I mean, there's no question that from a winter standpoint, that the winters were colder in the 80s than they were during the 90s. And here's where we get into difficulty in trying to figure out, is this a real long-term trend or is it cyclical? And you can go back and look at the records all the way through the 20th century and find other periods that were, you know, decades that were very mild and other decades that were very cold. Same thing with the hurricane. You know, the fact that we didn't have much of anything until the mid-90s, and then all of a sudden it's been a flurry since then. Is that, you know, a result of global warming? Is it a natural cyclical process? The one thing I like to point out to people, David, is that back in 1933, we had more tropical systems in the Atlantic than any other year in history. And there wasn't as much carbon dioxide in the air then as there is now.
Mm-hmm.
So that would lead you to believe that at least part of this oscillation is simply a natural phenomenon.
Yesterday on this program, we talked about global warming. You have been very vocal about the science behind global warming, whether it was legitimate or illegitimate, for the past few years. And you've had a little bit of a shifting in your thought. Let's talk about that a little bit.
I have. It's you can call a little bit of a mea culpa, if you will. But I think all through the 80s and the first half of the 90s, the reason that I was such a skeptic about this is that there was contradictory information out there. For instance, the satellite temperature measurements were not showing significant warming at all, whereas the land-based record was. And I didn't hear much about that in the media in general, and I sort of felt like the topic was being treated from a standpoint that we're gonna tell everybody all the things that point to it and sort of ignore all the things that don't. But it's gotten to the point now where, you know, not even looking at data, if you just look at what the landscape looks like in the polar regions, there is no denying that the ice coverage is decreasing significantly. I remember, I think CBS did a story up from Point Barrow, Alaska last summer, and if you weren't standing there and feeling the cold, just looking at the water with no ice on it, you would have thought that you were in the tropics. And so I think to say that it's not happening is putting your head in the sand. But I still think there's a lot of debate as to, is it all because of man? is it all cyclical, or is it some of both?
And you and I have had discussions, Greg, that it has been somewhat of an irritant to you that there are people in the mainstream media who just simply ignore the fact of what you see as the data.
Right. I mean, I just think that we, all of us in the media, owe it to the public to, you know, give both sides of the story. In other words, what parts of the data support this belief, what parts don't. I know that it sometimes, I actually had somebody from the Environmental Protection Agency tell me one time, off the record, and I'm not going to name him or anything, but he said that, you know, in order for them to get funding for research, that, you know, sometimes they have to play the worst case scenario, because if they don't make it sound a little scary, then it's unlikely that they're going to get the funding they need to do the legitimate work they want to do. And it's unfortunate that that's the case, but I think that's probably a common thread through a lot of America.
Greg, you've been here 23, 24 years, but when did you get your degree in meteorology?
In 1979.
79. When did you know you wanted to do this work?
Well, even when I was a small kid, I mean, like 4 or 5 years old, I loved snow, and I was petrified of thunderstorms, so there was something there early on. And then there was a public television show in Pennsylvania that was produced at Penn State, which is where I eventually went to school, and it was a 7.5-minute weather show every night, and it not only, the people there not only told you what they thought was going to happen, but went into great detail as to why. It was more of an educational type format. And the more I watched these guys, the more intrigued I got, and my parents were tickled to death that I had an interest in something that was not against the law. And so they were very supportive and drove me up to Penn State even when I was a sophomore in high school. And I knew in 10th grade what courses I was going to have to take and what I was going to have to do the rest of the time in high school to get ready for it. And my wife claims that I'm very lucky that I was able to obsess about one thing, because she claims that I really haven't been able to focus on much else the rest of my life.
Well, I'm glad you shared that story, because one of the things that I think draws people to you is the fact that you do enjoy teaching others about what's happening in weather patterns versus just talking about the existence of a weather pattern.
Well, and, you know, I've got a little bit of an admission to make here, is that when I first got into the business, the whole idea of having a meteorologist on TV in this area was new. And, of course, it's sort of old hat now, but I often resented a little bit, to be honest with you, the fact that the weather was the vaudeville part of the newscast, where it was, you know, a lot of people in general that you know, didn't take it all that seriously and didn't have a science background. And so I sort of felt like, gee, this is an opportunity to make people aware that this is a science and that there's a lot of background to it. So there was probably a little bit of a chip on my shoulder when I first started. But, I mean, over the years, it's just become something that I love to do, and I like to share with other people who have a common interest.
Yeah, and, Greg, over the years, technology obviously has changed the way all of us in the business do our jobs. How has it affected forecasting and what you do and what you have to do?
To tell you the truth, David, I think in some cases there's so much information available now that it makes the job tougher than it was 20 years ago. I mean, I remember in 1981, all we had was a wet paper facsimile machine. It had a roll of wet paper in there, and this drum spun around, and it burned the image into the paper. And you only had one or two computer models to look at, and so you really didn't know if there were other possibilities out there other than just through your own experience. Now, there's two models from Europe, there's one in Japan, one in Canada, the Navy has one, people in research offices all over the country are running these models now because the computing power is so much better that it doesn't take a supercomputer to do this anymore.
And of course you have the Doppler 5000.
That's right, and that's really, you know, just to be honest here, we used to call it the Doppler 5000 forecast, and I think some people got the idea that we could use the Doppler to forecast the weather 5 days out. It's probably a forecasting tool for all of about 30 minutes.
All right. Very quickly in forecasting, any chance at all, as we look at this moisture we're having today, that we'll see anything white on Christmas morning?
You know, I don't want to say 0%, because that's only God knows that for sure, but it's about as close to zero as it can possibly be. For snow lovers, it doesn't look good.
One last thing. Are you still petrified of thunderstorms?
I still think that lightning is God's most effective way of reminding us who's in control.